This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Conquerors hold our fascination across time. What drove Genghis Khan or Tamerlane to sweep across Asia, Caesar through Gaul? Why did Napoleon test his legions against the Russian winter? Who are the people behind these great and terrible deeds? More than 2,000 years after his death, we still ask these questions about Alexander. The greatest conqueror of them all remains an enigmatic figure. Born a prince in an obscure kingdom in the Greek hinterlands, by the end of his brief life, Alexander controlled an empire that stretched from the Mediterranean east to the edge of the known world. History tells us he was a brilliant tactician and administrator, that he spread Greek culture into Egypt and across the Middle East, that even before his death at the age of 32, many worshipped him as a god. And today, of course, he rides across the silver screen at your local Dodecaplex in Oliver Stone's new movie. This hour, we'll put aside the bronze wigs and demobilize the computer-generated armies to talk about Alexander, what drove him, what he did, and why it still matters. Later in the program, we'll bring you an update on the political crisis in Ukraine and talk about an army that is going home. Yesterday, almost all U.S. troops pulled out of Bosnia 9 years after they arrived. What did they accomplish? What's left to do? But first, we want your questions about Alexander the Great, his deeds, and his legacy. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now is Paul Cartledge, professor of Greek history at Cambridge University, the author, most recently, of Alexander the Great, The Hunt for a New Past. He joins us from the BBC studios in Cambridge, England, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Welcome. Thank you so much, Neil, for inviting me, and may I say happy Thanksgiving to you all.
Of course, you don't celebrate Thanksgiving there.
We don't, but we know all about it, and we're missing your pumpkin pie.
Well, thanks. We'll maybe send you a piece FedEx.
Thank you so much.
Macedonia. Did Alexander grow up thinking of himself as a Greek?
Yes, and as a Macedonian. The two are, as it were, like Chinese boxes. One enfolds the other. He spoke a language which was not easily intelligible outside Macedonia to other Greeks. On the other hand, Macedon, in the sense of the genealogy of the Greek people, Macedon, the original ancestor of the Macedonian people, is right up there, right at the top of the family tree, as it were. So they're kosher. They're certainly Greek, but because of their fringe location, as you rightly said in your introduction, and because of their contact with non-Greek peoples, from whom they borrowed a good deal of language, their idiolect, their local language, was not easily understandable by, as it were, standard Greek speakers from elsewhere in the Greek peninsula.
And it's important to understand about Alexander's life that there is topography and divisions and differences within Macedonia itself, upper and lower.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The western upper part is a highland area, a hunting area, and a forested area, an area divided into six what we call conventionally cantons on the Swiss model, and the, as it were, tribal leaders there are sort of barons. That terminology is often used, whereas the eastern part, more lowland, more cultivated in every sense, both metaphorically and literally, that was where the palace of Philip, Alexander's father, was located, where Alexander was born to his mother Olympias in 356 BC.
And to earn the right to be a man, a Macedonian youth, a noble kid, had to go off into those mountains and kill a boar.
Yes, and you've got to remember that whereas today in France, for example, wild boar hunting is an annual sport, a great cultural, social festival, they use high-velocity rifles. The ancient Greeks had a spear, a particular kind of spear, very reinforced with an extra strong blade, but nevertheless, it's literally eyeball to eyeball with this snarling, snorting, many-pound weight of muscle hurling itself at you in a fury. And so you had to, of course, have some nets, you had to have helpers, but ultimately you must make the kill. And this Alexander achieved at a very young age, before he was 16.
And this raises the question. Now, he was schooled, of course, groomed for greatness, I suppose, by his mother, but he was hardly the only prince of Macedon.
Well, there was one other possible contender, and the problem really was that Philip was polygamous, serially polygamous, and this is absolutely normal in Macedonia. This is not a peculiarity of Philip. And Olympias, Alexander's mother, was actually Philip's fourth wife, and she was a Greek. She came from northwest Greece, from roughly on the border with what's Albania today, and she produced him, and he was the obvious successor. There was another person of the same generation, but not obviously as competent as Alexander as he grew up. Mm-hmm. But the risk was that Philip would marry again and produce an heir who was Macedonian on both sides, because Alexander is Macedonian only on his father's side. He's Greek on his mother's side. And this indeed happened. In 337, when Alexander was about 19, Philip took a seventh wife, a pure and actually very elite Macedonian lady, a young girl, in fact, and proceeded to not only marry her, but get that lady pregnant. And therefore, the risk of another heir rivaling Alexander, though 19 years younger, was a very present threat, and I believe it triggered a response in Olympias.
And thus the rumors and speculation about the nature of Philip's death.
It must always be speculation and rumor. You can't prove anything other than that the unanimous view was who killed him, namely a guy called Pausanias, one of his very close bodyguards. He was assassinated in a theater, which is rather appropriate in a way. It was a tragedy in more than one sense, at his daughter's wedding, the full sister of Alexander, in other words, the daughter also of Olympias. And he was being father-in-law to Olympias' brother. So Philip was linking his family to the royal house of the Molossians, from which Olympias had come. This was an enormously symbolic moment. And Philip had, well, he might perhaps, you could say, committed an act of hubris. He had a statue of himself fashioned. Whether it was a likeness or not, we can't say. It wasn't precisely a cult statue, that is, a statue to be worshipped, but it was carried with statues of the 12 Olympian gods, the 12 that the Greeks all commonly worshipped. So Philip is sort of making a statement, and if you like, he was cut down for perhaps going a little too far.
We're speaking with Paul Cartledge, the author of Alexander the Great, The Hunt for a New Past. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's talk with Charlie, who's on the line with us from Wichita, Kansas.
Well, when you were talking about Alexander, I was reminded we have a monthly dinner at different restaurants, and our waiter one night was from Macedonia. And we were talking about the Olympics, and he broke in and said, you know, the last Macedonian to win gold at the Olympics was Philip, father of Alexander. So is that true, and would that have any influence on his need to excel?
Well, it's certainly true that he did, but he won it in a horse race, and therefore he personally, Philip, was not actually riding. This was a quite standard thing at the Olympics. In the running and in the track and field events, the heavy events, the wrestling, the boxing, and so on, the people competed themselves. In the horse race and the chariot race, it was perfectly okay. You have your own horse racing, but you hire a jockey. And this is what happened in the case of Philip's, as it were, gold medal. He won an Olympic crown just before Alexander was born, and he received that message that he'd won this Olympic crown at the same moment that he received the message that his son Alexander had been born.
What an interesting coincidence. Thanks.
Yep, a nice one.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. Yeah. What about Charlie's broader point? Was Alexander just trying to live up to dear old dad?
Well, that's an extremely deep point and terribly important, and some historians think this is actually the motivation for all of Alexander. That's to say, his father had been the biggest thing in Macedonia, and indeed the biggest thing in a way in that part of the Greek world ever. And Philip was just on the point of launching his own expedition against the Persian Empire, in which Alexander was apparently not going to be given any active role. In other words, Alexander would be left behind as possibly regent. He'd already been appointed regent once before. So the fact that Alexander was not part of the original plan may say something for what Philip thought of Alexander. In other words, there was rivalry and emulation on both sides. Well, Philip gets killed, and some people think that Alexander is sort of shadowed by this image of this great father who was cut down in his prime, age 46, and that Alexander was always motivated by the desire to not just equal, but supersede, to surpass Philip.
Mm-hmm. And sorry.
I was just going to say that I think that's part of it, but I think there's a lot more going on, that Philip was not the sole motivation. Alexander's also out to beat Achilles, one of Homer's prime heroes. He's also out to rival Heracles, who is an ancestor of his, as the Greeks understood these things, on his father's side. He's out to rival Dionysus, who went to India, according to Greek myth and legend. So Alexander will go to India, and he will do things even better than Dionysus. Remarkable.
Many, I suppose many of us who want to hit more home runs than Barry Bonds or,
absolutely.
Whatever, but few of us actually go out and achieve those dreams that we have as boys or young adults. Alexander did it all.
He did, and one thought is that it wasn't just his father that he was motivated by, but more directly by his mother, who was quite clearly estranged from her husband by the end of his life, by the time he was assassinated. And quite a lot of people, and not without reason, thought that Olympias actually was behind the murder of Philip in order precisely to make way for Alexander to succeed and to step into Philip's shoes, which he did. There's a nice story in one of the sources that Alexander, a little tired of his mother's importunities, she was always sort of pestering him for this and that, said, "My mother charges me a very high rent for the 9 months that she housed me in her womb." And I think that's really good, because it shows that Alexander had this kind of snappy wit, this sort of repartee, which is more usually associated with the Spartans, actually.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Bill is with us from Reno, Nevada.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to ask the professor, when I was in Salonika, I saw in a museum there the skeleton of Philip, and the bones looked to me as if he were no more than perhaps 4'10 or something like that. Was he that tiny?
That's a very good question indeed. It's not absolutely certain that that skeleton is Philip. I know what you're referring to. You're referring to the tomb that was excavated
right.
at modern Vergina, which is ancient Egai, and that is actually where Philip was assassinated. And they built a huge tomb for him. I think probably the tomb that they identify as Philip's tomb was Philip's tomb, and then over that tomb and two others, they built a huge mound, and it wasn't actually found, it wasn't excavated until 1977. It's quite extraordinary that it lay there for 2,300 plus years. And you're absolutely right that Philip would have been short. Alexander's thought to be little over 5 foot, so it wouldn't be at all surprising if his father had been of that sort of size. Remember the horses they had then were more like what you and I would call ponies.
Yeah.
And since Alexander was a cavalryman and he led his army from the cavalry, he had to have a horse that was not too enormous, otherwise he wouldn't be able to manage it, because they didn't have saddles, they didn't have stirrups, and he had to guide the horse with his knees and by holding on to the mane. So he was small, pint-sized by our standards, but probably not absolutely tiny by ancient Greek standards.
I have a short question.
Can you hold on to it, Bill, because we've got to wait to the other side of the break.
Okay.
All right, I'm just going to put you on hold, and we'll get back to you when we do come back from a break. Stay with us, Professor Cartledge, and if you'd like to join the conversation, it's not too late, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. We'll be back in a minute or so. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the real story behind the latest cinema heartthrob, Alexander the Great. Who was he, actually? What changes did he make in the world? Why is he still relevant today? Of course, you're invited to join us. If you're from a part of the world that Alexander conquered, how is he remembered there? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us today from the BBC studios in Cambridge is Paul Cartledge, author of Alexander the Great, The Hunt for a New History. Just before the break, Bill was on the line with us from Reno, Nevada. Bill, you had another question?
A short question for the professor, please. There have been hundreds of conquerors, of which Alexander is one of the greatest, of course. Are they not all essentially completely evil people? Thank you.
Leaves the easy ones for last, yeah.
Yeah, quite. And, well, there's one issue for me as a historian, which is whether or not I am in the business of passing moral judgments. But I think other people are probably better placed than I to talk about that. On the other hand, I think probably anybody who's called the great can't be entirely good. I mean, it seems to go with a certain amount of wickedness, or at least people think that they've suffered. And you were saying earlier that not everybody within the area that was Alexander's empire thinks of him today with equal warmth, that is, with equal positive warmth. One group of people, the Parsis, who are Zoroastrians, followers of Ahura Mazda, many of them, and there aren't many of them left, but many of those that are in Bombay and elsewhere, they think of Alexander in a very negative light indeed. They believe he destroyed their sacred books, which were housed in the capital of the old Persian Empire, Persepolis, as the Greeks called it, where there were a number of palaces, including the latest one, the palace where Darius III, Alexander's opponent, lived, and that he burnt it symbolically. It was a way of making the point that he had control now, and he was going to, as it were, wipe out the old, and fire would have meant quite a lot to the people that he was conquering. But on the other hand, he behaved in this way, and it was not regarded with equal warmth and with equal pleasure by those people who claimed descent from the Zoroastrians of the late 4th century BC.
Well, joining us now is Barry Strauss, a professor of classics at Cornell University, the author of The Battle of Salamis, the naval encounter that saved Greece and Western civilization. We caught him at home in Ithaca, New York, and good to talk to you again, Barry.
Good to be here. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. And let me begin with that question that Professor Cartledge was just dealing with. Was Alexander an evil man?
I would say that would be one side of Alexander. Alexander did some undeniably bad things, engaging in massacres, killing far more people than he needed to do as a warrior. But I'd also say that we can't simply reduce Alexander to evil, because of the consequences of his conquests. In part, they were unintentional, but they weren't entirely unintentional. As a result of what Alexander did, cross-fertilization between peoples over a huge region, between the East and the West, became possible. And that changed civilization. It changed history for the better in many ways. We wouldn't be who we are today without what Alexander had done, what Alexander did. And I think that when we think about things like multiculturalism, living in a multi-ethnic society, equality among different peoples, there is a little bit of Alexander in all of that. And so in spite of the evil things he did, he also did some good things.
Well, let's continue the conversation with our listeners and get another caller on the line. Keith is with us from Enfield, New York.
Yeah. Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Greetings to the professor from Cornell.
Okay.
In the area. Anyway, I was just wondering, when Alexander made his went into Egypt and made his trek to, was it the oasis at Suwa? I'm probably mispronouncing that.
Paul Cartledge, we run into these problems all the time because of these words we read and never hear anybody pronounce.
Well, I was a classics major. I'm just not remembering the oasis. Anyway, Alexander went out to an oasis, supposedly was told by the Egyptian priest there that he was a god, and then then in the coinage after that, he appears with horns on his head, which means that he is a god, according to their beliefs. So I was just wondering if anybody had any comments on that.
Well, Professor Cartledge, why don't you begin on that? Was this a... go ahead, I'm sorry.
With pleasure. This was an extraordinary side trip. It was at a time before Alexander had finally defeated Darius, and the question arises, you know, what on earth did he think he was doing? So he goes some 300 kilometres, he goes west right across to the, we normally call it the Siwa Oasis, which is a very big oasis indeed, lots and lots of trees, lots and lots of water, still flourishes in a certain sense today. What exactly he was told, I'm afraid the sources are such that we can't say for sure, but one notion that I think Alexander was very happy to run with was precisely what your caller has said, that in some sense the priest was telling Alexander that the god Amon, who is Amun for the Egyptians, he starts out in Memphis, and then the Greeks call him Amon, it's as in Tutankhamun, it's the same god, was his father. In other words, Alexander, in some sense, is either descended from, ultimately, or is actually procreated by Amon. And so either of those would make quite a striking claim for Greeks and Macedonians, that Alexander had a special relationship with a non-Greek god. Your caller is absolutely right. Sorry, if I can just continue about the coin. Those horns are precisely the representation of Amon. And so there is an identification there in the coinage. But exactly when those coins were issued, that is not exactly clear.
Barry Strauss, did Alexander, do we know whether Alexander considered himself as, you know, being told that story? I might think I was pretty godlike too, but I also might think it's a pretty neat way to rule the Egyptians.
Yes. And by the way, let me say hello to my good friend Paul Cartledge.
Likewise. Happy Thanksgiving, Barry.
Thank you, Paul. I think that one of the reasons that Alexander is so fascinating to us is that with Alexander, you never quite know. He was a brilliant politician and tactician, and as you say, Neil, he would certainly have found it advantageous to have himself declared a god. But he was sufficiently crazy, sufficiently emotional, and sufficiently willing to let people think he was crazy that he just might have believed in it as well.
If I could just come in on the Egyptian side, Neil, your point, that as he was a sort of pharaoh, whether or not he was formally crowned pharaoh of Egypt, he had to be, as it were, a living god for the Egyptians. And the Egyptians, remember, had been very upset by the Persians. It's one of the very rare cases where Persian policy in religious terms had been heavy-handed. So Alexander was actually welcomed as a liberator and in religious terms.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Mohammed, who joins us from Minneapolis.
Yes, my question is really, I'm coming from that part of the world, and I'm a Persian, I'm proud of it. But what really is really serious is the degree of hypocrisy at West and too much emphasis on what Alexander did, and not enough about Cyrus the Great and Hachmonician dynasty, which they had a great impact on emergence of the man. How come it is totally, to me, is a hypocrisy. Would you explain that, please?
Who wants to take that one?
I'd be glad to say something about that.
Go ahead, Barry.
I'd agree with the caller that we need to pay more attention to the Achaemenid Persian influence on Alexander and indeed on the West. In many ways, what Alexander did was take over the Achaemenid machinery. The Achaemenid Persians invented this great empire, and Alexander largely used their administrative structure and indeed some of their ideology and staffed it with Greeks and Macedonians. But I wouldn't say the problem is hypocrisy so much as simple ignorance. I mean, I think we're just very ignorant about that part of the world, and we Americans and that Brits as well are learning, we need to know more about it, and Persia would be a very good place to start.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up. I think that's an excellent answer. And just add that if we were to talk about what we understand about the way the Achaemenids ran their empire in terms of religion, they were quite remarkably tolerant. I mean, it's slightly difficult to use a word like tolerant because it sounds post-Enlightenment, but they did not seek to impose their particular religion on all the peoples of the empire. Far from it. They tried to insert themselves and to work with the religions of the empire. And there's one thing which, of course, now, Muhammad might not be quite so excited about this as some others of your listeners, but it was Cyrus, of course, who restored the Jews from their Babylonian captivity to Palestine. And so in the Jewish sacred text, Cyrus is a great man. He's a great liberator. So it's very interesting just to see how, looking from different perspectives, absolutely right, the Persian Empire is a pretty remarkable phenomenon.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Natasha. Natasha's calling from Berkeley, California.
Hi. Actually, I wanted to say greetings to first of all, greetings to your guest.
Hi, Natasha.
I wanted to see if your guest can comment on the event where Alexander ordered 10,000 of his Greek soldiers to marry Persian women, and what were the Hellenistic influences on Persia? And at the same time, what were the Persian influences on the Greek civilization? And I have a comment to make. And being from Shiraz, Iran, which is where near Persepolis is, Alexander was not really liked. So,
okay. Well, Barry Strauss was the marriage of the Macedonian soldiers and the Persian women. Was that part of the multiculturalism you were talking about?
Yes, I mean, it certainly was. We shouldn't look at it with rose-colored glasses. Alexander was trying to unite Macedonians and Persians, but he wasn't trying to do it because he was a nice guy. He was trying to do it because he wanted to create a new ruling race that would be neither Macedonian and Greek on the one hand and neither Persian on the other hand, but a combination of both. It would be a mixture, and it would also be dependent on him. To be successful, because to some extent the children born of these marriages would be neither acceptable to Persians on the one hand or to Macedonians and Greeks on the other. So it is multiculturalism, but multiculturalism for a political end. But it is, in fact, multiculturalism. And one of the things that we see in the Hellenistic period, Alexander, of course, is hated by most of the other Macedonians for doing this. We find the Macedonian successors to Alexander willy-nilly doing the same thing. They create, in effect, honorary Macedonians by enrolling non-Greek, non-Macedonian people, sometimes Persians, sometimes Syrians, sometimes Jews, sometimes Egyptians, all sorts of Eastern peoples enrolled in their army as Macedonian soldiers, and they are called Macedonian, even though they're really not. So this is the beginning of a kind of multiculturalism.
Almost seems to anticipate Rome in a lot of ways.
It certainly anticipated the Romans, and it had a big influence on the Romans and the notion of Roman citizenship, and therefore, indirectly, it had a big influence on us and our notion of mass citizenship.
Natasha, you had a comment?
Oh, no, sorry.
Okay, thanks very
much. Could I just add that Alexander, of course, married not just one, but two Persian women in that same ceremony as the 10,000, and something like 85 or 87 of his close elite companions of the commander class also married Persian, typically, at any rate, Iranian women of various sorts. So it wasn't just for the soldiers, it was also for him. But of those 90 or so elite, only one retained his Persian wife, and very interestingly hung on to her and remained married to her, and he became Seleucus, who founded the Seleucid Empire, which was the one that succeeded to most of Alexander's Middle Eastern empire, the largest single chunk of Alexander's empire.
We're talking about Alexander the Great with Paul Cartledge of Cambridge University and Barry Strauss of Cornell. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk now with Billy. Billy's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Billy. Go ahead.
Yes. I saw in the news that the Greeks are kind of up in arms about this new release movie because it portrays Alexander as being bisexual. Is there any historical evidence to support that?
Paul Cartlett.
I think when one answers that question, you have first of all to clear away any modern notions of what sexuality is. In other words, today, and it's not that long since we've done this, it only goes back 100 or so years, you define yourself in terms of your sexual orientation and preferences. Are you homosexual? Are you heterosexual? Are you bisexual? Ancient Greeks didn't think like that. They thought that it was appropriate to have sex with members of both genders in the right place, at the right time, at the right age, in the right amount. They didn't have any overarching religious dogma which said that homosexuality, i.e. relations with members of your own sex, was wicked, evil, and you would be consigned to hell for it. On the other hand, they didn't positively say that it was absolutely better to have sex with your own gender than to have sex with somebody of the opposite gender. So it would be odd if Alexander had not had sex with both men and women. I'll leave it at that and back if need.
Well, I just wanted to add, there's one of the great lines in your book. You say that you're tempted to describe the two great loves of Alexander's life as dumb brutes.
Yes, well, one played in the movie by Jared Leto is Hephaestion, and he was a little older, not much, than Alexander. He was taller than Alexander, and almost certainly, at one stage in their lives, their relationship was sexual. It remained thereafter, even when there was no sexual dimension, if there wasn't, immensely passionate, and when Hephaestion died, just before, as it happened, Alexander died, Hephaestion was buried with a massive pomp, and Alexander was utterly distraught, and he wanted all sorts of huge, really gross honours for Hephaestion and so on. The other dumb brute was a four-legged one, by the way, a horse, so I'm not suggesting that he had any kind of relationship other than a purely military one with that horse.
The famous Bucephalus. Barry, let me ask you, this is we only have a little time left, but sure. This is an email from Dito Morales in Little Rock, Arkansas. As an art historian, I'm always intrigued by these high-budget movies that try to reproduce antiquity. If you're familiar with it, how does the movie do in the way of faithfully depicting the architecture and the clothing?
I thought the movie did a very interesting question. I thought the movie did a great job with the costumes. I thought the clothing, to the extent that I know about it, was spot on, as our British friends might say. And one of the things that I found also very interesting about the movie was digital Babylon. They did indeed use a lot of the Babylonian art that we see in the great museums of Europe and the U.S. So it seems to me that they were reasonably good about that. The one thing that did strike me is that Alexander spent an awful lot of time in tents. And the Persians were famous for the splendor of their tents. And I thought the movie underrated tent life.
Paul Cartlett, give us a 10-second review of the movie.
Well, I've not seen it, so I'm in a slightly difficult position there. But every review that I've read has been pretty negative. I don't know why, but Barry sounds more positive than I've been led to think he would be.
I think it's just headline writers like to say Alexander the Putrid or something like that. Anyway, thanks to you both. Barry Strauss, happy Thanksgiving to you at Cornell.
Same to you.
Paul Cartlett, happy Thursday there in Cambridge.
Thanks, Neil, for inviting me.